In addition to MCAST, a subscription to emedhome.com includes over 1,000 video lectures from the best EM conferences, with more added all the time. View on any device whenever and wherever you want. All this and so much more, including hundreds of CME credits each year for the low cost of only $99. emedhome.com. For 20 years, the homepage of emergency medicine. Subscribe now.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the February 2019 issue of EMED Home's EMCast. This is Amol Mattu at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and once again, we have a great issue for you this month. We've got three great topics. We're going to kick things off by talking about something that we have never talked about before. It's something scary that we face not infrequently, and I don't think there's really a lot that we've learned from major conferences or textbooks about how to manage these patients, and it has to do with managing patients in the emergency department who have critical aortic stenosis. These are really, really sick patients, and honestly, in all of the reading and lectures I've done, there's really not a lot out there in emergency medicine that provides this direction. Well, it turns out that there is a pretty nice article published in the emergency medicine literature not too long ago, which actually does give us some direction, and that's what we're going to focus our time and attention on. Then we're going to talk once again about the dizzy patient. I know by now maybe some of you are getting dizzy thinking about and listening to dizzy, but this is going to be the wrap-up for at least a little while in our focus on the dizzy patient. In past months, we've talked about the general approach to dizzy, and we've talked about the approach to the patient that has sustained dizziness, and now we're going to wrap it up by talking about the patient who has episodic dizziness. And if you learn how to tell the difference between, and even to just distinguish the fact that there is a difference between sustained dizziness versus episodic dizziness, I think that is huge in terms of nailing down how to manage these patients. So this month, we're going to talk about the patient coming in with episodic dizziness. And then we're going to wrap things up by talking about a common deadly complaint that is hyperkalemia. And I know that may sound pretty basic, bread or butter, but we're going to talk about an article that focused on controversies in hyperkalemia. Hey, before we get started, I want to let everyone know about a really great upcoming free conference. It's going to be our fourth annual Emergency Cardiology Symposium, being held right here on our campus at University of Maryland School of Medicine here in Baltimore. Check out the website. It's emergencycardiologysymposium.umem.org. Once again, emergencycardiologysymposium.umem.org. And this year's focus is going to be on acute heart failure. We've got some fantastic international stars that are coming in. Well, they are international stars, but they're primarily just from the United States. We've got Al Sacchetti, who's coming from New Jersey. Al's going to be talking about the general approach to pulmonary edema. We've got Samar Tuweld, who's from our own campus. She runs our emergency cardiology fellowship. She's going to be talking about which of those heart failure patients need to be admitted and which can go home. Peter W. is going to bring his ASEP lecture talking about managing hypotensive heart failure. Susan Wilcox, who's EM, IM critical care, is going to be talking about pulmonary hypertension and right heart failure. Anand Gopalswamy from California is going to be talking about LVAD complications. He's one of the best speakers on this particular topic. And Samantha Wood, who's EM, IM critical care from up in Maine, is going to be talking about what to do with these end-stage heart failure patients, the ones who have gotten heart transplants when they have complications coming into the emergency department. It's going to run from about 7:30 to 12:30. It's going to be on our Wednesday conference day, and we are going to work on making live stream possible, but every year we get about 200 or 300 people to show up in person and interact with these fantastic speakers. Make sure to register on the website so we know how much food and beverage to provide. Just go to that website. Once again, emergencycardiologysymposium.umem.org, and hit the register button. Register. Hope to see you there. By the way, did I say it's free? That's right. There's no cost for attending this conference. You can't say that too often, can you? Anyway, let's get on to this month's EMCast. Okay, well, let's get going with the EMCast this month. Our first topic for the month is going to be aortic stenosis. This is a topic that we haven't talked about before, but it's certainly a high-risk topic and a very important topic. Nicely, there was an article recently published in Journal of Emergency Medicine called Evaluation and Management of Aortic Stenosis for the Emergency Clinician, an Evidence-Based Review of the Literature. And this was published just a few months ago in 2018. Joining me to discuss this topic is Dr. Lean Oblehead. Lean's been on the EM cast before. And just to recap, she's one of our faculty. She's also doing a faculty development fellowship. And last year finished an ultrasound fellowship with a special focus on echo. So Lean, you'd say your major area of interest is not just ultrasound, but emergency cardiology. And yes, where these two areas intersect is echo.
Yep.
And so you must love valvular disorders. One of the very few people in the world who probably actually has an appreciation or an interest. I won't say love, an interest in valvular disorders.
You can say love. It's okay.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. You definitely may stand alone out there. So I don't dislike valves, but it's not my most favorite thing by any means. So anyway, it's nice to have an article as an excuse to talk about this topic of aortic stenosis. It's something that we review in the board courses, and there's not a lot that I really say about aortic stenosis, except that in terms of management, you're really walking on thin ice in many ways, because these are potentially really, really sick patients.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, well, let's get into this. So just as some background, can you tell us what exactly is aortic stenosis, and how common is it, and who's at risk? When do we need to worry about patients having aortic stenosis?
Yeah, sure. So aortic stenosis essentially is narrowing of the aortic valve opening, right? So there's this restriction of blood flow from the ventricle to the aorta, and then thereby affecting hemodynamic stuff we're going to talk about in the next few minutes. In terms of how often you see this, like you said, it's not uncommon. I'm sure we all came across the patient that we listen to, and we listen to that crescendo, decrescendo murmur. The cardiovascular health study.
Decrescendo, decrescendo. All right, that's good.
Did I say decrescendo?
No. That's exactly what it is, but I think most of us just hear a systolic sound.
I was teaching medical students a couple of weeks ago, so it stuck in my head.
I think in the emergency department, you're lucky if you just hear the murmur.
And you know it's systolic or not.
Right, and then you kind of say, you look in the history and find out the patient has aortic stenosis, and then you tell the medical students, oh, do you hear the crescendo, decrescendo? So anyway, all right. You're just showing off. Okay, go ahead.
So the cardiovascular health study found that 26% of people over 65 years old have aortic sclerosis, and 2% of them have aortic stenosis. And with their increasing age, that number goes up. So anybody over 80, you have a 10% chance of getting or finding somebody with aortic stenosis.
Okay, so aortic sclerosis is a term that I really haven't heard before. How are you distinguishing aortic sclerosis? What does that mean versus stenosis?
So aortic sclerosis and stenosis are pretty much on the same line or spectrum. Aortic sclerosis is when there's thickening of the valve without significant effect on the heart function or the blood flow.
Okay.
So that's a start of the disease.
Got it.
And then later on, when it becomes stenotic and smaller than half the size of the valve, then it's causing problems in terms of, we're going to talk about the problems that aortic stenosis causes, then you can call it aortic stenosis. It's when the blood flow is more difficult to go from the left ventricle to the aorta.
Okay, so generally, is it 50% a stenosed? I guess when the lumen is 50% stenosed, then it's called aortic stenosis.
Yes. So the aortic valve normally is about like 3 centimeters square.
Okay.
So when it goes down to 1.5.
Got it.
Then you can, and you hear the murmurs and you see the, you know, clinical findings of it, then it becomes stenosis.
Okay.
When they have symptoms.
Got it. Okay. Thanks for clarifying that.
No problem.
So what exactly causes aortic sclerosis and aortic stenosis? Is it purely something that occurs naturally with age, or is there some type of genetic issue that we need to be asking patients about?
Yeah, so aortic stenosis occurs basically due to inflammation of the endothelial damage, mechanical stress, lipid penetration. I love that description, lipid penetration into the valve, fibrosis and thickening of the valve, and eventually it gets calcified. The endothelium over the valves is very similar to the arteries. So pretty much what causes atherosclerosis in the arteries and coronary arteries, it's the same, almost the same process that causes your valve sclerosis and calcification. The most common causes are calcific, congenital, and rheumatic valve disease. And the article goes on to talk about the calcific aortic stenosis. And this develops in normal tricuspid aortic valve. And the stenosis is pretty much, like I said, similar in a process to atherosclerosis of your arteries.
All right, I'm going to interrupt you here for a second. You mentioned tricuspid. So are we mixing our valves here?
So no, what I mean by tricuspid aortic valve is that the aortic valve has three cusps in it.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm talking about when I say tricuspid valve. So essentially when it starts with a mild calcification of the valve cusps, sclerosis essentially, and then it worsens over time into stenosis. Now, of note, the article mentions that the calcific sclerosis in of itself is a risk for cardiac death. It's an independent risk for cardiac death, which I found very interesting. And those born with bicuspid aortic valves, and you hear that term bicuspid aortic valve, is that when the aortic valve has two cusps in them, which is about 2% of the population, they have a higher risk of calcification in their aortic valves. And this is why we see it more commonly, or say that if you have a bicuspid aortic valve, you're more at risk of sclerosis and stenosis. And then they actually demonstrate aortic stenosis about two decades earlier than normal population. So for your normal population, you expect them around 60s or higher. In those with bicuspid aortic valves, you can actually find that in their 40s.
Wow.
Yeah. The other type of or cause of aortic stenosis is congenital aortic stenosis. This is essentially diagnosed in early childhood. Some articles went on to say maybe you can see somebody in their 30s or 20s with this congenital aortic stenosis. Here, the patient is born with a unicuspid and unicommissural valve. So everything is pretty much fused, and it's just one cusp. Unfortunately, they can present with sudden death. And I hate when that's a presenting symptom for anything.
Right. And what ages are we talking about? I mean, so, is this like in infancy or?
So childhood. They didn't determine when, but yeah. Other articles, because I was very interested in this. So I looked up other articles and they were mentioning that they had case reports of people presenting in their 20s and 30s with this.
Okay.
So you can possibly find somebody older than an adolescent who has this. They don't demonstrate angina or heart failure symptoms. They might have LV strain on an EKG. So if you get that EKG and find LV strain, especially in a child, I would suggest you get an echo to look at the valves, make sure they're not one of those unfortunate people born with a congenital aortic stenosis.
With a single cusp, it's hard to imagine that you can survive at all with just one cusp.
Yeah, it's essentially a tiny hole in that cusp. If you look at the pictures, it's just marvelous.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I say marvelous because I love ICOs, but it's not marvelous for the patient.
No, definitely not.
The third cause of it would be rheumatic valve disease. Now, I know this is rare in the United States, but pretty much everywhere else around the world, it still does exist. Usually, in this case, patients also have mitral valve involvement. And here, with the aortic valve, there's actually fusion of the commissures and the valve, and they present similar to the congenital type because everything is stuck together. And all this means is that aortic stenosis results in a stiff and narrow orifice. This increases the pressure gradient across the valve, and then LV pressures become higher, and then you have LV pressure overload, and then you get hypertrophy as a result of all this. And all of this results in the classical triad that we hear about in aortic stenosis, which is angina, syncope, and heart failure. And the article goes on to mention something really scary, is that once those symptoms develop, so if you have a patient who presents with angina, syncope, or heart failure, it's pretty much a downslope from there. Their mortality rate increases to 25% just by having those symptoms in the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
So there's not a lot of time to fix it. Right.
So if they get it fixed,
that drops your mortality and they have a better prognosis.
Right.
But this just points that if you find aortic stenosis in the ED, whether by exam or echo, just make sure to tell the patient to either follow up with cardiology depending on their symptoms or admit them for replacement of that valve depending on where they show up in their clinical picture.
Right. I mean, I guess if they came in because of either the angina, the syncope, or decompensated heart failure, then they're probably coming in.
Absolutely.
But if it's an incidental finding, then I think you definitely have to refer them.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Good to know. Okay, Lene, you mentioned that aortic stenosis has this classic triad of angina, syncope, and CHF. And the way I always remember it is with the mnemonic aortic stenosis disease, ASD, stands for, ASD also stands for angina, syncope, and decompensated heart failure. So that's my mnemonic for ASD. So that's the classic triad. We always teach that for the boards. Mm-hmm. And I guess as you go from angina to syncope to decompensated heart failure, your prognosis gets worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. What else should we be looking for on history or physical?
Unfortunately, like you said, the symptoms can be subtle too. So mm-hmm. they not necessarily present with any of these things. And the other symptom that they can present with is sudden death, right? So, only one
not so subtle.
Not so subtle, right? Only one third of those patients may have symptoms that you mentioned, the angina, syncope, and shortness of breath.
So only one third of the sudden death patients had preceding symptoms.
Only one third of the patients with aortic stenosis may have symptoms before they die.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's scary.
That is scary. And also it occurs late. So 3 to 5 years after their disease process has started. And like we mentioned earlier, at that point, they will narrow their valve, to about half the size, right? And that causes the pressure gradient that we mentioned. So with aortic stenosis, your LV pressures increase and your afterload increase. And I want you to think of afterload as the stress on the wall. So it's a product of pressure multiplied by radius over thickness. And in order to overcome the pressure, your heart starts to thicken, right? And hypertrophy. Now, this is good for your ejection fraction because you're going to pump against a higher pressure, so you're able to improve ejection fraction. But what it's bad, the downside of that is it impairs coronary blood flow and worsens diastolic function. So this essentially increases diastolic pressures, which leads to pulmonary congestion and their dyspnea and why they're presenting with shortness of breath at times. Eventually, the patient's contractile ability of the heart declines and then they go into heart failure. Another symptom we talked about was angina. And this is because when you have hypertrophy of the left ventricle, you essentially increase the demand of oxygen, but decrease the ability to perfuse your endocardium because of the increased filling pressure and the longer distance that the coronaries have to travel through the myocardium to feed the endocardium.
Okay.
Oxygenate the endocardium, I should say.
So increase myocardial oxygen demand, but decrease the coronary flow leads to ischemic chest pain.
Right.
Okay.
And also, like, the increased diastolic pressure in that left ventricle also hinders the blood flow to the endocardium because imagine, like, it's squishing onto the endocardium.
Sure.
So not a lot of blood is able to feed that area.
Okay. That makes sense.
So syncope is the exact mechanism why they have syncope is not fully understood, but it's thought to have happened due to exercise or activity because of the limited outflow that goes across the valve to increase or to give you enough stroke volume that is needed during that exercise or activity. So that's what they think is causing syncope.
All right, so we've got the ischemic chest pain due to increased myocardial oxygen demand and decreased flow and diastolic dysfunction leading to heart failure and then decreased cardiac output, essentially, abrupt drop in cardiac output can cause syncope, and mm-hmm. those are the hallmark or triad of symptoms.
Right.
Is there anything on the physical exam that we need to be on the lookout for? Obviously, the murmur, which I guess you'll get into, but anything else?
So, signs of heart failure. So, you listen to the lungs. You listen to, you know, you hear rattles or crackles in the lungs. They might have severe shortness of breath, dyspnea. You know, their pulse ox is a little lower. So, they're present pretty much like a congestive heart failure patient.
Okay.
Especially if they're in extremis. The murmur that you mentioned, like we talked about in medical school, it's a crescendo, decrescendo murmur. Initially, when the disease process just begins, you'll hear it at the beginning of systole. And then as the disease progresses, it's about mid to late systole. But what's interesting is that if the patient has aortic stenosis and you know he has aortic stenosis and you can't hear a murmur, that actually tells you that the disease process is so severe and you can't detect a murmur because there's so little flow across that valve that you're not able to hear the turbulence that it's causing.
Right.
So it's a really bad sign if you can't hear a murmur. Either that or you have a Fisher-Price stethoscope. But if you have a decent stethoscope and you can't hear the murmur, then make sure that, you know, the patient's not in severe aortic stenosis.
Right. Kind of like those asthmatics. Once you stop hearing the wheezing, then they're really, really sick.
Yes.
So, or they're fixed either way, right?
Or they're dead.
Yeah. So if you know somebody has aortic stenosis and you're not hearing the murmur anymore, then it can be a really bad sign.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if a patient with either known or newly diagnosed aortic stenosis shows up with any of the complications you listed, the AS or the D, what kind of workup should we do in the emergency department? What are we doing in the ED when these patients show up?
Yeah, sure. So EKG, right? Basically, in the EKG, you're looking for signs of ischemia or dysrhythmias, signs of left ventricular hypertrophy. You might see left atrial enlargement. And then try to find that LVH with strain pattern, because that's not a good omen. This just tells you that there's more chance of tissue damage and a worse outcome.
Okay.
The article talks about getting a CBC to check for hemolytic anemia. And if you think about it, it's just mechanical damage of your RBC through that stenotic valve. Troponin and BNP should also be ordered on those patients. And if you find a higher number of troponin and BNP, then that predicts a worse prognosis for the patient. Type and screen or cross match, because your patient's going to go to the OR eventually, so you're just trying to help your surgeons. Another thing you can get in the ED is a chest x-ray. And findings of aortic stenosis on chest x-ray would be a large heart, so a boot-shaped heart. Post-stenotic aortic dilatation is something else you could see. Pulmonary edema, like we mentioned, because of the heart failure. Or you can actually find something like a pneumonia or pleural effusion that may have exacerbated the current symptoms of the patient. And then the best test you can do, and the test of choice actually, is an echo.
All right.
So the patient has to get an echo, whether it's formal or in the ED by point of care ultrasound. You would look for the size of the LV. You would look for function, stroke volume. You can manage or measure your ejection fraction, and you can determine the causes of aortic stenosis. And also, you can determine prognosis and the timing of valves replacement, and when do they need their valves replaced, whether it's now or they can wait a couple of weeks. And also look for other valves. So look at your mitral valve, because if you have mitral regurgitation, this actually just tells you there's worse prognosis, worse outcome, because your LV is not filling as it should. And then there's worse pressure gradient for the blood to flow through. So it's just badness all over if they have another valve involved.
Got it. All right. Well, now for the real money question. We got the workup done, but now we are dealing with the patient who's pretty sick with aortic stenosis. Maybe they came in because of chest pain or heart failure or syncope. What do we do to treat these patients? Can we just do the usual stuff? If they've got chest pain, just throw some sublinguals at them. And if they're in heart failure, put them on a high-dose nitro drip or give them a big slug of furosemide. I mean, what do we have to do differently?
So, great question. Aortic stenosis is highly preload dependent. So your mainstay is, or your goal is to improve and maintain the preload of those patients, right? You have to manage the blood pressure and manage the heart rate. If your patient is hypotensive, for example, start IV fluids. You need your preload to be, to improve your preload. The article goes into, there's no specific type of fluids. You can give normal saline. It's quick and just there and ready. You can, if the IV fluids are not improving your preload, you can give them a touch of vasopressors, not so much, and make sure you use the lowest dose and for the shortest time possible. And the reason for that is that vasopressors actually will eventually increase your O2 demand, decrease contractility, and worsen the obstruction. It also can cause arrhythmias, and then the patient might go into cardiovascular collapse, which is something you don't want in those patients. If your patient presents in a hypertensive heart failure picture with pulmonary edema, the classical teaching was, you know, you should stay away from nitroglycerin and furosemide because you don't want to drop their preload. But newer studies came out saying that nitroglycerin did not show any worse outcomes in terms of lowering blood pressure than those who don't have aortic stenosis. And in fact, it can actually help with the afterload and reduce afterload. So eventually it will improve your cardiac output. So you should use your nitroglycerin in those patients.
Would you give them sublinguals or would you just go to a titratable IV infusion?
I would start with a titratable infusion just because it's more predictable.
Sure.
And that you can control it because you need tight control on those on the preload. They also talk about nitroprusside, that you can use it, and it actually showed improvement of cardiac output in severe heart failure. It decreases the filling pressure, and augments the blood flow to the myocardium, reducing ischemia and enhancing contractility. And there's a new drug they mentioned, levosimendan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's a calcium sensitizer, so it makes your heart more sensitive to calcium. And it's being evaluated with some promising results, but it's still not out there for use. But be on the lookout for this drug in the near future, I hope.
Now, I would imagine that some of these drugs are great for the hypertensive patient, but unfortunately, patients with aortic stenosis oftentimes are relatively hypotensive. Mm-hmm. And those are tough because you might be inclined to put them on a vasopressor, but there's problems with the vasopressors right. that you mentioned already. Right. So maybe a little bit of permissive hypotension,
right.
like keeping the blood pressure in the 90s, I guess, is probably okay if they're perfusing.
So, yes, and then they mentioned something that really scared me, is that those patients with aortic stenosis can have cardiovascular collapse at MAPs higher than what we're used to. So a MAP of 51 can actually cause cardiovascular collapse and aortic stenosis.
Wow.
So you want to maintain a good MAP in those patients. You also need to ensure that you have normal heart rates. So the heart rate, so both bradycardia and tachycardia are bad for them. So if you have a bradycardic patient, they're suggesting you can give dobutamine. It does reduce your afterload, increase your heart rate, and increase your contractility. If the patient is tachycardic, this is also bad because you have a hypertrophic, non-compliant heart that doesn't have time to fill now. So it can worsen your contractility and worsen your cardiac output. And here, you can give them calcium channel blockers, beta blockers, or even digoxin, but also be very careful not to drop their heart rate. So it's a tight balance between tachycardia and bradycardia. You essentially need them to be within a normal heart rate.
The Goldilocks phenomenon.
Make sure just right.
Just right, yeah.
Just right. The article also goes on to mention that if you need to intubate those patients for any reason, use a cardiostable drug like etomidate. If you're dealing with a pregnant patient with aortic stenosis, make sure she's on the left lateral so you can avoid the aortocaval compression. But essentially, all what we're doing right now, all these drugs, is just a bridge to the ultimate treatment, which is valve replacement. So you can, the cardiac surgeon can perform this either open or via transcatheter approach. If the patient is unstable for surgery, there are further bridging methods, so they can either do a balloon dilatation or actually put them on ECMO. But essentially, what you're trying to get is to replace that valve with a valve that is functioning.
Definitely. All right, well, that was a great review. Lean, how about this? Give us three key pearls that you would like to leave the listeners with after all this.
Sure. So remember, aortic sclerosis and stenosis can range from asymptomatic to sudden death. So keep that in mind when you see a patient with heart failure symptoms and look with the ultrasound to make sure you see the aortic valve and that's not the issue.
Okay.
Your aortic stenosis patients are very preload dependent. So start them on IV fluids if they're hypotensive and you can give small touches of pressors. If they're hypertensive, you can start the nitro. And be sure that you keep them in a normal heart rate. So tachy and bradycardia are bad for them. So find that balance, the Goldilocks phenomenon. And then third, your ultimate therapy is always going to be valve replacement. And there are other ways to bridge them, either through ECMO or balloon dilatation. So don't be afraid to call your consults for those.
And get them out of the emergency room.
Yes.
Okay.
Get them out.
All right. Okay. Well, that was a great review, Lean. Thanks so much for taking us through this topic. And we'll keep our eyes open for any other valve review articles that come out.
Yes, please. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you next time.
Thanks.
All right. Well, next up on the EM Cast, we're going to turn our attention back to dizziness. Unbelievably, we've done a lot of dizzy stuff in recent months. And I think this is going to kind of conclude the discussion for a little while at least. Back with me to talk about dizziness is Dr. Dizzy, Dr. Danya Koja.
Is that my new nickname?
That is Dr. your Dizzy. New nickname, Dr. Dizzy. So why are we doing this? Well, a couple of months ago, I think Danya talked about what to do with the patient that has persistent dizziness based on some literature that Jonathan Edlow has published. Dr. Edlow is definitely one of the leaders in emergency neurology in our specialty. And my take on what to do with patients that are persistently dizzy is essentially do a good history, good physical, and that's where the HINTS exam really comes into focus. And it's probably useful for all of us in emergency medicine to be very familiar with the HINTS exam. And there's some very nice videos on it. If you Google it, people demonstrating the HINTS exam, that goes a little bit beyond what you can hear on the podcast. And this week's, or rather this month's discussion is a little bit of a part two discussion. And I believe this talks about a more challenging patient population. What do you do with patients that have intermittent dizziness? And this is based on an article, Managing Patients with Acute Episodic Dizziness, published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine just in the past couple of months. And once again, Dr. Edlow is back to talk about what to do with these patients. I find this a lot more challenging. Danya, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but it's a lot more challenging when patients come in and they say, I was dizzy earlier, but now I feel fine. And of course, the main concern is this just a benign peripheral cause, or was the patient having posterior circulation TIAs? And now the HINTS exam is not useful. In fact, there's nothing on exam, I think, that's useful. A lot of it boils down to other parts of your evaluation. And that's where this article, and that's where you come in. So you're going to tell us what to do with these more challenging patients when their symptoms have resolved upon arrival. So welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me again to talk about dizziness.
All right. And for people that may have missed the last discussion, let's just review some of the basics. First of all, what exactly is meant when people use the word dizzy? And why don't you just kind of start us up with that, and we'll go from there.
So as you had mentioned, we had discussed extensively patients coming in with persistent dizziness, but kind of sum it up. Our classic teaching of trying to figure out what is the word that the patient wants to use to describe dizziness, is it vertigo, is it lightheadedness, that all makes no difference. Patients change their stories. I know, surprise, surprise. but there are studies out there that show that. And then our classic teaching was vertigo is neurology and lightheadedness is cardiovascular or whatever. And that's also not true. And coming back to that part also, a good history is the most important thing you can do to try to understand what the cause of the dizziness is. And as you had alluded to earlier, is that patients who come in with persistent dizziness, or what we refer to as acute vestibular syndrome, which is, you know, the nystagmus, the vomiting, feeling very dizzy, being unsteady, and so on, that would be one type. Or is it episodic, so it comes and goes? And then if it's episodic, we need to understand, is it triggered? Is there an actual clear trigger that makes them go from no dizziness, feeling well, to having their symptoms versus spontaneous? So the symptoms just come in by themselves with no clear precipitant.
Okay. And one of the things that you mentioned last time was something that I think I had been unclear about. Maybe other people have been unclear about also is that regardless of whether it's central or peripheral vertigo, head turning and stuff like that makes everything worse. So if they say that it worsens with head turning or positional maneuvers, well, that doesn't really narrow it down to peripheral or central because both of those get worse with head turning. So instead of talking about exacerbating features, you pointed us in the direction of talking about precipitating features or triggers.
Absolutely.
So what starts it? What sets it off?
So as you have pointed out, Amal, it's extremely important to differentiate a trigger that starts the episode versus something that exacerbates it. I mean, think about it. If you're dizzy from anything and you just don't feel good, shaking your head side to side is not going to make you feel better.
Even when you're not feeling dizzy, shaking your head. Yeah.
That's also true. So whether we're talking about a peripheral or a central cause, that part does not matter. And that's where getting a really good history and a really clear history is going to help you figure this out. And as you pointed out earlier, with people who are coming in with persistent dizziness, so they told you I'm dizzy at home and now they're still dizzy, then you can do the HINTS exam. However, you are not allowed to. It is actually illegal for you to do a HINTS exam on someone who's not dizzy right now.
I think I read that in Obamacare, actually. So.
And the problem with that is that you're just not going to be able to interpret it correctly. And as you pointed out, there's a ton of videos out there that kind of talk more about the HINTS exam. But today, what we're going to be talking about is the acute episodic dizziness and trying to figure out if it's triggered or spontaneous. Getting that good history is extremely important because if you're thinking that there's a trigger that made it happen, your differential is one of two things. It's either BPPV, so benign peripheral positional vertigo. There's two P's in there. They're always confusing. And then the other one is orthostatic hypotension. With BPPV, what tends to happen is that patients are turning in their bed at night. So they're just kind of like rolling over. And what wakes them up or what gets them out of the bed is the severe dizziness and vomiting. And those usually last for like a minute or two and then they go away. They may last a little longer because now they are feeling very anxious or anticipating that dizziness is going to happen. And going to the basics of BPPV, what happens is that you have an otolith that gets stuck in the posterior semicircular canal, and that gives you that false sensation that there is movement or a rotation. And that's why people feel dizzy and like they want to throw up, or actually do throw up. And figuring out that that was the trigger that got this to happen, so they went from feeling perfectly fine to having these symptoms, is your key to actually opening this box. And in order for you to figure out if it's BPPV or not, then you need to do a Dick's Hall Pike. The Dick's Hall Pike is the one where you have people sitting up, they bend their, you ask them to turn their head to one side, and then you lower the head of the bed at a 45 degree angle with their head. And of course, there's a ton of videos out there that are pretty good. And if it's positive, which means that they start to have the symptoms and start to have the nystagmus on one of the sides, then that's the side that's that has the otolith, or and that way you confirm your BPPV. 85% of patients with BPPV are going to have a positive Dick's Hall Pike maneuver, which is a pretty good number for a cheap test that takes 45 seconds to do on each side. If your patient comes in and they have like your typical story for the BPPV, they tell you that they were feeling perfectly fine, they turned around in bed, and they started to have this severe dizziness and vomiting, and their Dick's Hall Pike is negative, there's something very similar called a supine head roll or a barbecue, actually.
Supine head roll sounds like something the French invented with the guillotine.
I'm totally thinking like sushi, actually, with that, like a roll.
All right.
Right? So
what exactly is the supine head roll?
So the idea of the supine head roll is that you're trying to target, or you're trying to move the otolith, not from the posterior semicircular canal, but from the lateral or horizontal canal. And with that, instead of their head being at 45 degree angle when you're lowering them down, they stay at like at the same plane as the rest of their body.
Okay.
And that is going to catch almost everybody. So if you're able to do these maneuvers correctly, and a patient's coming in with clearly triggered dizziness, then that should make it easy for you to figure out that they have BPPV.
Okay. Then do you normally just go right to the supine head roll if it's going to catch nearly everyone, or do you have the Dick's Hall Pike first?
So the Dick's Hall Pike is going to capture 85% of people. And then the rest of them, the 15%, are mostly going to get captured the supine head roll. There's a bunch of other maneuvers because there's one more semicircular canal that we're not addressing with that. However, it is so rare, I don't think that it's something that's worth working with.
Okay, so between the Dick's Hall Pike maneuver and then the supine head roll, you're going to pick up they'll be positive in nearly every case of BPPV.
Absolutely. If you're doing the maneuvers correctly, absolutely.
Okay. Are there false positives? Like, will you induce the symptoms and yet they're actually having a posterior stroke or something like that?
So I forgot to tell you that part. So it's illegal for you to do the Dick's Hall Pike on someone who's actually dizzy already.
Okay.
Because the whole idea is that you're trying to induce this dizziness, right?
Got it.
And that's the problem, is if you use it in the incorrect patient, the patient who has persistent dizziness, then you're not going to interpret it correctly, and that's where you're going to come up with a false positive.
Okay, all right. So the hints in this are very complimentary. Hints you only do in people that are symptomatic. This one you only do in people who are asymptomatic.
Absolutely, 100%. Nice. That's okay. The law. You read it.
All right.
So okay. If you use it in the correct patient, then that is diagnostic and you're done.
All right, cool. Do they need referrals at that point?
So you usually don't need to refer patients. If their Dick's Hall Pike is positive, then you can just keep going on and do the Epley maneuver, which is where you have them, you start off with a Dick's Hall Pike on the side that is affected, and then you attempt to kind of reposition the otolith in the canal by having them continue the roll. And that's how, it's something that you can also Google or YouTube and look at that maneuver. The majority of patients are able to be treated with that maneuver. Some patients are a little more challenging. You can refer them at that point to like physical therapy, or you also have like vertigo clinics that can help continue that maneuver for you.
All right.
But the only ones that, if somebody comes in with a really bizarre picture, like the nystagmus that you come up with a BPPV is different. Obviously, they have exam abnormalities that are present with what looks like BPPV, then you should start thinking that they may have a very rare kind of BPPV, which is central BPPV. And that's a person that definitely needs follow-up with neurology.
Okay, so now you're worrying me, because I kind of thought that if we do this Dick's Hall Pike maneuver and then the supine head roll, then we're going to, if they're positive, then that's going to rule in BPPV, which is peripheral, but now you're telling me that there's a central BPPV as well.
So you, before you did the Dix Hall Pike, you did a neuro exam, and that was normal, correct?
Okay. Yeah. I just walk in the room and start rolling people around.
So if a person has other abnormalities, so let's say they have a new cranial nerve abnormality, right? That doesn't go with your story of BPPV. If they're coming in with other symptoms, like they're having a lot of headache, that doesn't go with BPPV.
Okay.
So basically, if it's somebody who's having symptoms that are not consistent with BPPV, they have other neurological abnormalities, whether on their history or exam, then you should ask yourself, are you using this test on a person that you're not supposed to use it?
Got it. Okay, so you're going to do a good history and physical exam, and if you come across any, I guess what we would call central signs or symptoms, then you're going to head down the central pathway and forget the rolling the patient around. But if they've got nothing on history or physical that's suggesting central, their cranial nerves are all normal, they don't have obvious ataxia or anything like that, then you're going to go and start rolling the people around.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say roll people around. Okay, all right, got it.
That's exactly what it is. You just roll people around.
Okay. And also, will those people with the central BPPV be treatable with the Epley maneuver?
No.
No, okay.
And that would be one of your hints, is that you're doing the correct maneuver and it's something you're comfortable doing and it's just not working.
Got it. Okay. All right. So what are the other things in the differential we need to know for this triggered episodic vestibular syndrome?
So something we're very familiar with, which is orthostatic hypotension. Whether it's from an occult bleed, from a ruptured aortic aneurysm, massive PE, whatever it is that's causing this orthostatic hypotension, the patient could come in describing these episodes of vertigo or lightheadedness that are triggered, but they're usually triggered by going from laying down to sitting, from sitting to standing, so change in the posture. You should never, ever have orthostatic hypotension if you're rolling around in bed,
okay,
which is your typical story of BPPV.
Right.
And with that, I think it's something that we're really, really good at thinking about, knowing the differential for it. So understanding, again, getting a good history, understanding what the trigger is that precipitated that episode of dizziness, whether, again, it's vertigo or lightheadedness, doesn't matter. Understanding what the trigger is allows you to go down that pathway and start looking for the cause for this possible orthostatic hypotension.
Okay. All right. So we've talked about the triggered episodic vestibular syndrome. In other words, the dizziness is clearly triggered by something, rolling around in bed or maybe going from supine to upright near syncope and so on. You earlier had mentioned that some of these cases can be spontaneous episodic. So there's nothing that they do and bam, it just hits. So what about the spontaneous episodic vestibular symptoms?
So spontaneous episodic is one of the more frustrating ones, because with that, there is, in our reality, not much that you can do from an exam standpoint to figure it out. Your differential for that is either a vestibular migraine or Meniere's disease or your posterior circulation TIA.
Okay, and that's the bad one.
That's the bad one.
That's the worst one, I should say.
Pretty much. I mean, vestibular migraines do increase your risk, or having a migraine does increase your risk for a stroke. So that in and of itself is not as benign as it sounds.
Sure.
But for that particular episode itself, while they're not having an actual stroke right now, it does increase the risk on the long term. And vestibular migraine is really the big one. The tricky part about it is that in order for you to say that this person has vestibular migraine, I'm assuming they're coming into the ED with their first episode, right? Or their second episode.
Right, sure.
They don't have a clear diagnosis that's been followed up by neurologists. In order for you to say, hey, this person has vestibular migraine, the official diagnosis requires that a person has had 5 episodes or more of the vestibular migraine. So you're going to be one of the first people to see them before they've had that diagnosis established, before they've even satisfied the criteria to have that diagnosis. The other thing is that when we think migraine, we think headache. With vestibular migraines, headaches don't necessarily occur at the same time as the dizziness. And in some patients, it does not occur at all. So they don't have a headache. So if you want to think that a vestibular migraine must have a headache with it, then you're going to be missing out on that group of people. So the patient is actually having dizziness at that moment. If you happen to catch them as one of these episodes of dizziness, you're going to check for nystagmus, and their nystagmus may actually look central because migraine is a central process.
Right. All right. Well, that's not really fair. You can't tell me somebody's having a migraine and no headache. All right. Well, that does make things.
So, interestingly, I actually, one time, this was a couple years ago, I was at home. I was feeling well. Nothing was wrong. And I started seeing confetti. And I was like, huh, you know, I'm such a happy person. I see confetti out of nowhere.
And you were awake during this.
I was completely awake. It was like middle of the morning. And it happened a few times. And I actually talked to an ophthalmologist. And they're like, oh, yeah, those are ophthalmologic migraines.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was like, wait,
you never
what?
Told me about that. That's interesting.
Oh. It was completely bizarre. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, wait. So you mean this is an aura before the migraine happens, right? Because I never got a headache with that. Okay. And they're like, nope. Sometimes it can just be that would be your migraine.
Really?
You just see these confetti, not flashing lights, confetti.
Yeah.
And it was it.
Wow. How long did this last?
I had quite a few episodes over like a few weeks and they were gone.
And they were a few seconds or for?
Yeah, they would last for a few seconds. The first time I seriously thought there was someone throwing confetti around.
Wow.
But I was by myself at home, so that was weird.
All right.
So yeah,
well, that is interesting.
You don't need a headache to diagnose a migraine.
Okay. All right. Well, good to know. What else? You mentioned that we need to think about vestibular migraine. You also mentioned Meniere's and posterior circulation TIA. Any comments about Meniere's?
Meniere's is so uncommon in the ED, it really doesn't matter, right?
Okay.
You just need to know
like
it.
That.
You just need to know, because I mean, if you miss a diagnosis of Meniere's, it's not a big deal, right? It's a patient who comes in, they have these episodes of dizziness, they're spontaneous, there's no trigger, they may have hearing loss. They give you a feeling that their ears are full. Now, the problem is that if you see a person who has a posterior circulation TIA, and instead you just diagnose them with Meniere's and discharge them. So please don't do that.
Okay, so just, I guess, if nothing else for board's purposes, Meniere's is always one of those triads that we're supposed to know. And it's a triad of vertigo, hearing loss, and a feeling that the ears are full, or tinnitus, is that? Potentially something.
Yes, so tinnitus is the third one of that triad.
Okay.
But then the other thing is oral fullness. And I'm like, how do people even describe that? But
yeah, I don't know. We have some patients that have Meniere's, but they always come in with a known diagnosis of Meniere's. And of course, those are very rare. I don't think I've ever been the person to diagnose Meniere's. So that makes sense. It is fairly rare, except at ABEM General Hospital. So you've got to know it for the board exam. All right. And then the third part of the differential there is posterior circulation TIA.
So posterior circulation TIA is the one that scares us, of course. And the problem is that from our classic education, we used to falsely think that it's a rare thing, which is why it wasn't hammered into us or taught to us, I guess. Studies show that patients with posterior stroke are more likely to have had dizziness in the 2 days preceding their stroke, making you think that this dizziness was actually a TIA. And then half of these patients had just isolated dizziness with absolutely nothing else. No other neurosymptoms that they're reporting. Mm. And then the other thing that was also a false, I guess, understanding or an incomplete understanding of the pathology is that we used to think that if a person were to have a posterior circulation TIA, they're less likely to convert that into a stroke than a person who comes in with an anterior circulation TIA. So somebody comes in and says that they're dizzy and that's a posterior circulation TIA. The likelihood of that turning into a stroke is a lot less than your, I had slurred speech, it lasted for 2-3 minutes, it went away, and that was my anterior circulation TIA.
Sure. And when these do become strokes, they can be really devastating strokes, which is why we're talking about this. And these, you always hear about these cases within our system or elsewhere or lawsuits exactly like this, where a person has some episodes of dizziness and they're kind of not really taken seriously or misdiagnosed, and then they end up coming back with a full-blown posterior circulation stroke, and they develop cerebral edema and craniotomies and just really awful outcomes. So, all right. Well, any tips on how to diagnose the posterior circulation stroke or TIA?
Unfortunately, there's no, like, exam maneuver for this. So you got to make sure that you take a really good history. And if it's a person who comes in with lots of risk factors, so they have a history of strokes, history of like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and things like that, and they come in with episodes of dizziness that have absolutely no trigger, so they're truly spontaneous, then this is definitely a person you need to consider seriously for a TIA.
Okay, so it's almost, based on what you're saying, it's almost like a diagnosis of exclusion. Well, maybe I shouldn't say it that way, because usually diagnoses of exclusion are low concern. But when a patient comes in, you want to evaluate them for all the other things. And if you don't clearly have a diagnosis of BPPV, or you don't clearly have a diagnosis of Meniere's, which is rare, or clearly have a diagnosis of the vestibular migraine, then you should definitely be assuming that this is a posterior circulation TIA that they had.
Absolutely. So if you have a person who's coming in with episodes of dizziness, they are clearly spontaneous, and they have not been diagnosed with a vestibular migraine in the past or Meniere's disease, look at the patient as a whole. And if they're vasculopaths, they have a lot of risk factors for developing cerebrovascular disease, then you're done.
Okay.
You need to take them seriously, and you need to consider them for TIA. But in order for you to even get to that point, you would have had to, one, recognize that their dizziness is dizziness, mm-hmm. not just vertigo or lightheadedness. It's all one big box. And then get that good history that allows you to realize that it is episodic rather than continuous, and that it is spontaneous rather than triggered.
Okay. Just as an aside, what if you are worried about that, what imaging test are you going to?
So with posterior circulation TIAs, you would handle them just the same way you would handle regular TIAs or intercirculation TIAs. And you've actually talked about that on a podcast before. So the workup that you would do is that you would get an MRI. However, the question for that is, depending on the risk factors of the patient and how likely they are to convert it into a stroke, then you can question whether or not this needs to happen in your emergency department or in like a clinic within 24 hours, because there's a lot of OBS units that are popping up to handle TIAs, and in that they would do like the echo, they do the Dopplers, in this case, the CTA to look at your vertebrals, if that's a concern, and plus minus MRI, depending on how high risk they are okay. and where you are in that workup.
All right. Are you routinely doing CTAs of the neck, or are you just going straight to the MRI if you're really worried about this?
I think it depends on how high risk the patient is, and depending what kind of follow-up they have. If I know that they're going to go and see their neurologist tomorrow or be able to get an MRI as an outpatient, they're relatively low risk from the standpoint that they don't have, like, you know, valvular heart disease, they don't have a new murmur, they don't have a known cervical vascular disease, then those patients can do that. However, if they have something in their history that's more concerning for an acute vertebral injury, so for example, they were seen by a chiropractor recently, or they had some mild trauma or something like that, obviously with neck pain, those are the ones that I definitely would want to do a CTA before they
sure.
leave my ER.
All right. Okay. How about a quick wrap-up? Let me ask it to you this way. A patient comes into your emergency department, and they had an episode of dizziness a couple of hours ago, and they are now asymptomatic. What are you doing with those patients? Just as a quick wrap-up of what you've talked about.
So I'll take the chart from my box, and I'll put it in your box.
Great. And I'm going to try to put it back in yours. So.
So the first thing that you got to do is not fixate on the fact of, is it dizziness, is it vertigo, is it lightheadedness?
Okay.
Just we're past that now, right? Just try to understand, is this dizziness still present right now? Is it a persistent dizziness, or if it's episodic? If it's persistent, then those are the ones that you need to do a HINTS exam and think down the cerebellar stroke lane. If it's episodes of dizziness that come and go, then you really need to understand, is it triggered by something, or does it happen spontaneously? If it's triggered by something, is that something change in posture, as in going from supine to upright, or is it moving or rolling around in bed? If it's rolling around in bed, you're not really changing your posture, that's kind of straightforward. It's BPPV.
Okay.
You do your Dick's Hall Pike, you do your spine head roll, and if either of these are positive, you're done. It's a slam dunk.
Okay.
If they're negative, then, well, do them again. Maybe you just didn't do them right the first time.
All right.
And then, of course, you think of orthostatic hypotension. With episodic dizziness that is spontaneous, then you have one of three options. It's either going to be a posterior circulation TIA, which is a scary, scary thing we got to think about, and in a patient who has a lot of risk factors, that's going to be your diagnosis.
Sure.
Unless you have a really clear diagnosis that's been done already of Meniere's disease or vestibular migraines, which are your other two differentials for spontaneous episodic dizziness.
All right. Great. Well, if I had confetti, I'd throw it for you right now. So, all right.
Thank you.
That's very, very helpful.
There's actually a really great pathway or an algorithm that is mentioned in this paper, which was published in Annals by Dr. Edlow, that we're discussing today that kind of just differentiates that and allows you to have this systematic approach for dizziness.
Great. All right. Well, thanks to Dr. Edlow for putting these papers out, and thanks to our own Dr. Dizzy for reviewing these papers. You know, when I send these topics out for the faculty to take a look at, there's only one person who ever responds to any dizzy topics.
Me.
Exactly. So otherwise, they would just be hearing crickets. So, Danya, thanks so much once again for helping clarify this really tough diagnosis. And I'm somewhat looking forward to seeing my next dizzy patient now.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, next up on EMCast, we're going to spend some time talking about a very common topic in emergency medicine, and that is hyperkalemia. So everybody knows about hyperkalemia, I think. But it turns out that maybe a lot of what we've learned is myth or controversy. And there is a nice article that came out recently in Journal of Emergency Medicine that talks specifically about, as the title would say, controversies in management of hyperkalemia. And we're going to go through this article and see if what we think is true is actually true. Joining me are a couple of colleagues that you've heard before, Dr. Michael Bond, who is our residency director, and Dr. Ryan Spangler, who's one of our assistant clerkship directors and one of our faculty. And he's been on the podcast a number of times, dating all the way back to when you did your faculty development fellowship. And gosh, that was
2014 or 2015. Yeah,
that was a long time ago, it seems. So anyway, thanks for coming back. And one of Ryan's areas of particular interest is nephrology, and that always overlaps with metabolic stuff. And God bless you for having an interest in stuff like that. So, but hyperkalemia is kind of fun. So anyway, let's get into this topic. So first of all, Ryan, let me just ask you a little bit. Can you give us a brief discussion of why potassium is important in the body and what some of the causes of hyperkalemia? Just a little background about the topic before we really get into the management issues.
Certainly. So potassium exists in our body in order to help us maintain our cellular membrane potentials and ultimately get action potentials in your electrically active muscles, cardiac, nerves, muscle tissue, skeletal muscles, things like that. And so a differential exists between the intracellular environment and the serum in your blood, which is what we're actually measuring now. And that's the long and short of it right there. That's why it's important. And that's why you can also see that abnormalities in your hyperkalemia or your hypokalemia can actually lead to problems with electrical conduction, whether it's in your heart, your nerves, your muscles, etc. from there. Now, as Amal mentioned, there are several different kinds of hyperkalemia that you can experience. The most common of which we're going to run into is what they call factitious hyperkalemia. And this is what we tend to see a lot in the emergency department. You get the call from the lab that, hey, this blood is hemolyzed, their potassium looks high, do you want us to repeat it? What do you want to do with this? And why is it like that? And that can be due to lab error in their processing and handling of the samples. It can be due to the initial blood draw in the first place. And so trying to make that as smooth of a process, nice clean blood draw with a good flowing vessel there, and quick evaluation in the lab is going to help eliminate some of that flaw that we're going to have with the laboratory data there. In general, usually these patients don't need to do anything about it except maybe repeat their potassium to make sure that it's actually normal.
Sure.
And you should be a little bit more suspicious of this kind if you really don't expect the patient to be hyperkalemic. It's a young, healthy person with normal kidney function, no real injury, anything like that, and maybe no medicines that you would expect to cause hyperkalemia. We see this a lot with outside patients that had an outside lab draw and they get a call from the lab or the doctor says, your potassium 7, you need to go right to the emergency department. I don't think that they have any disillusion that the patient actually has a potassium 7, but they need to get it repeated. It needs to be repeated fast in case that it's actually true.
Sure.
And so we end up seeing a lot of these patients.
Sure. It always seems that, at least I believe in Dr. Murphy working in the emergency department and in those patients where you really are worried about the potassium, that seems to be when it gets hemolyzed.
Right.
You have to wait extra long. But, sorry.
I think that's where the lab is just sometimes concerned that the value couldn't be correct. So they just want you to repeat it anyway. And you really want to know what the value is.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder, too, if we could just get our nurses to place more 18-gauge angiocatheters instead of the 20s and 22s, if we'd have a lot less hemolyzed blood.
Yeah.
First step there is to get people to stop using injection drugs, I guess. Yeah. So, but I guess the other maybe clue is that, if the creatinine's normal, then it becomes very unlikely that somebody's truly hyperkalemic. And fortunately, the creatinine, I think, should not be influenced by hemolysis.
That's correct.
So, I remember a nephrologist many years ago saying that it's almost impossible to be hyperkalemic if your creatinine is truly normal. But unfortunately, a lot of those creatinines are just, you know, 1.6, 1.7, and then it could be just about anything.
That's so, right. Yeah. And that, you know, that kind of leads us to our next type, which is actually a increased release of potassium from cells, whether it's breakdown of blood cells or more frequently what we'll see in the emergency department or in trauma patients is rhabdomyolysis. Mm-hmm. You can have an elevated potassium. And then also you may have issues where endocrine problem, whether it's your aldosterone processing or your kidney response to aldosterone, things like that can also cause an increase in your potassium. That likely times you may see some mildly elevated creatinine in some of these patients, but not necessarily exclusively.
Sure.
And then the final type is your decreased potassium excretion, which is probably what we're most familiar with, what we see the most in our most critical hyperkalemic patients. And that's generally your renal failure patients.
Right.
It's 90% cleared by the kidneys.
All right. Michael, what are the clinical manifestations of hyperkalemia?
I guess the one that everybody worries about, the one that everybody knows really well, is cardiac manifestations.
Death.
Death. That would be the worst part of it. But we think about all the different arrhythmias, and we always say that, like, hyperkalemia is the syphilis of EKGs, where it could do anything to it. So whether they have just peak T waves to QRS widening to the sine waves that we're really concerned about. But I think any really bizarro EKG should immediately make people think of hyperkalemia. But the ones that people forget to worry about is it affects the nervous system, too. So paresthesias, they can have just generalized weakness. They can have full-blown paralysis with hyperkalemia or hypokalemia. And then it could cause GI symptoms too. Nausea, vomiting, which is, I think is on the differential of any disease process. And then diarrhea too can be caused by hyperkalemia. So I think we forget about the GI and nervous system ones because I don't think anybody's ever died from those. But the cardiac one's the one that everybody always knows about.
Sure. All right, well, let's get into the management just a bit. Ryan, the paper divides the various treatments into some categories. Can you kind of split that for us, what the categories are?
Yeah, certainly. So the three categories of treatment are your membrane stabilization, redistribution of the potassium, and then ultimately elimination of the potassium. And so membrane stabilization mostly means trying to avoid those cardiac abnormalities that Michael had mentioned just a minute ago. Is you want to prevent that heart from going into a fatal arrhythmia. Avoid those EKG changes or reverse those EKG changes if
sure.
you can. Redistribution, meaning that, you know, we're not actually taking the potassium out of the body, we're not moving anywhere, but we got places to put it in the body, so let's try and get it there rather than in the bloodstream where it's going to be causing problems. And then finally, elimination, which is our ultimate goal is to actually get the potassium out of the body and back down to a normal level.
Sure. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and take us through the first of those steps, the membrane stabilization.
So membrane stabilization, as I mentioned, is trying to avoid any of those electrical problems, particularly with the heart is usually what we worry about due to the hyperkalemia. And like Michael had mentioned, you've got the EKG changes. You may see peak T waves, widened QRS, things like that. Worst case, your sine wave abnormalities and ultimately death. But what we use primarily to do this is calcium. It works rapidly and it works very effectively. It's actually, I think, one of the coolest things that you can see if you've got a nice wide QRS complex on your monitor and you actually can watch it narrow on the monitor as the calcium drips into the patient. It works in just a couple of minutes. And it can last about 30 to 60 minutes, roughly. And so that gives you some time to initiate some of your other therapies while you've got the heart stabilized and you can really keep the patient out of trouble by doing that. So this, if we have a hyperkalemic patient, especially if they have some of those EKG changes, should be the first thing that we initiate.
Sure. How much do you normally give?
It's a good question. So the paper references that you can use just about 10 mLs, 1 amp of calcium gluconate, will be generally enough in a lot of patients. And in my experience, I think that generally does seem to work well. It talks about the difference between calcium gluconate and calcium chloride. Calcium chloride, unfortunately, can be very irritating to some of the vessels and cause some problem if it extravasates. So unless the patient is critically ill or has a central or deep vessel line, generally it's used to avoid that. And plenty of the studies show that calcium gluconate is perfectly adequate. Some of the protocols that I've seen use 2 amps of calcium gluconate because it does have a little bit less calcium. But I think the bottom line is if you get the effect that you need to see, if you narrow up that QRS complex, then that's the amount that you need to give. If the one dose isn't enough, then you may need to give a second one. You shouldn't be too shy about doing
sure.
that.
So, and that'll buy you about 30 to 60 minutes to then start trying to do step number 2, which is, you mentioned the redistribution or shifting of the potassium. And that's what the next section of management talked about. Michael, can you take us through that?
Before we get there, though, I'd just like to debate. You mentioned that you would give calcium regardless of what the EKG is. And the article doesn't talk about this at all, but I actually think there's a bad downside to calcium. So I personally only use calcium if there's EKG changes. If the EKG is completely normal, I don't give calcium to stabilize something that's not there. I'll do serial EKGs if I'm really worried. But I think people really downplay calciphylaxis. When they have calcium phosphate binding, people get hard concretions in muscles and other parts of the body, and there's no treatment for that at all. And it's a very painful condition, especially in seen in people with end-stage renal disease. So I think if they have EKG changes, and I'm looking for, I personally look for more than just a peak T wave. If it's a really peak T wave, nice and sharp, I'll do it. But if it's just a little bit of a T wave, then I tend to watch them a little bit more. Definitely QRS widening, anything else, I use calcium. So I'd like to get your guys' thoughts on it. Because I know a lot of people just think with all hyperkalemias, they have to do calcium. But I don't know why I'm giving it unless I'm trying to change my EKG. And if it's normal, then I don't feel like it needs to be given.
So overall, I actually agree with that pretty much across the board. With maybe a few small caveats is, one, if you have the EKG changes, you're obviously going to give calcium. I think we all agree on that.
No debate.
And that's what you're going to have at your bedside right away and giving it early. If you have no EKG changes and then you're checking labs, you'll have their potassium back, and that's ultimately what's initiating your other therapy, which maybe you were or were not as suspicious. I think if you have no EKG changes and no labs back, I would not be giving calcium just on the suspicion that it's hyperkalemic.
Sure, yeah.
So just to throw the debate at you, potassium comes back at 7, normal EKG. Do you give calcium, don't give calcium, or just give the other meds that we'll talk about in a second?
So more than likely, I'm probably just going to give the other meds that you're talking about there, unless maybe they're also hypercalcemic. But at that point, you have your labs back. You're generally going to have your calcium back with your chemistries as well. If they've got a normal or even slightly elevated calcium, as sometimes these patients may have, then that is doing the job in of itself and maybe why you don't see the EKG changes in those patients. If the calcium's low, I may be a little bit more likely to give it, maybe for both those reasons, only for the reason that the EKGs unfortunately don't necessarily follow a predictable progression. You're not going to go from normal EKG to peak T waves, to prolonged QRS, to flat P waves, etc. It's possible to go from hyperkalemia with normal EKG to cardiac arrest. And so especially if the calcium's a little bit on the low side, I probably am going to give that up front with the other medicines. But if the calcium's normal to elevated, then I'm more likely to just to start the other therapies of redistribution, potentially elimination.
And I agree, and the article points that out, that the EKG is not pathognomonic for hyperkalemia and there's not a progression. But I don't know anybody that's going to go from a normal QRS to cardiac death without any change whatsoever. I don't think it's going to be like one heartbeat, all of a sudden they got cardioplegia and they're dead. So I think there's going to be some changes, but I think it would be more appropriate to do serial EKGs. And I think that's the thing.
Yeah.
They come into the ED, they get an EKG and triage, and 6 hours later, labs are coming back. They probably need some EKGs in between. And if you can't get one, then yeah, I might give them calcium.
Serial reassessment, I think, is always beneficial.
Yeah. So that's a good point. I guess we oftentimes tend to think of calcium as really no drawbacks, but like with every other drug, there are some pros and cons to think about. And the cons may be not terribly common, but they still exist. And if the EKG is completely normal, then it may be reasonable to not jump on the calcium that early. Now, we're not saying that you don't treat just the lab value. You still probably need to treat a potassium of 7, even with the normal EKG. But the question is, do you need to use calcium?
Right.
And probably not. So,
and I think clinically it may also come into a little bit of also somewhat opinion-based, but if their potassium is, you know, 6.7, 7 in an end-stage renal person who's chronically hyperkalemic versus they come in and their potassium is 9 or 10, I personally feel like my threshold may be a little bit edging more towards the calcium if their potassium is extremely high.
Sure.
Just because it's going to make me a little bit more nervous in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It's not a particularly evidence-based opinion as far as that goes, but I feel like on a clinical basis, that may be the way I would lean.
Yeah. Well, probably never will get good evidence on something. Nobody's going to randomize to a study like that.
I find it hard just to get the lab to report a lab value of 9 or 10, and I've had a couple of patients like that, but they just feel like that's so incompatible with life that it has to be just a complete lab error. But we've had some of our chronic dialysis patients get that high and actually look quite well, amazingly.
Yeah.
For having that high of a potassium level.
You're waiting for the lab to call back, they're busy diluting it from 10 and down to 7 or 8 or, I don't know.
Yeah.
It would be nice if they called and said, hey, we got a potassium that's really, really high, just to let you know, but we're diluting it. But they never seem to do that at any hospital I've ever heard of. So.
And I always tell them to release the labs when they call back and say, are you expecting this to be? I said, just release it, let me look at it, and I'll decide if it's what we are expecting or not.
Yeah.
We've been calling you for hours.
Yeah. Okay, so Michael, we're going to use calcium if there's concerns on the EKG, maybe hold off on the calcium, but we are still going to shift that potassium if it's elevated. Now, what kind of things can we do to do that?
Now, I don't know if you want to just mention this, but the article did talk about in patients that are hyponatremic that hypertonic saline can also be used to stabilize the cardiac membranes. I've never used that before, so I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, I haven't heard that before, actually.
Yeah. So 3% hypertonic saline can be used to reverse some of the EKG changes of hyperkalemia too, but it's only really been shown in hyponatremic patients. So if your calcium is running out or if it's on short supply because of all the issues, hypertonic saline. But as far as shifting, the three main drugs that we typically always use are insulin, D50, and then albuterol, and then sodium bicarbonate normally comes up too as another drug that we can use. I think insulin and D50 are the ones that everybody reliably uses all the time. Insulin works really quickly, typically within like 5 to 10 minutes, and has a duration that can last up to 90 minutes. It helps by activating the sodium potassium pumps and shifting potassium into the cells in exchange for sodium. And that's how all of this transcellular shifts work. Insulin is definitely the main drug that we're trying to give, and then we just give the D50 or the glucose in order to make sure that they're not hypoglycemic. And the article does a good job of talking about this, but we've definitely have found in our own experience that it's typically taught 1 amp of D50 and 10 units of regular insulin. But at least in my experience, I always find about an hour later, they're all hypoglycemic and completely unresponsive. So I've gone to always giving 2 amps of D50. And I think the reason why they're so at risk for the hypoglycemia is, one, the effects of insulin last a lot longer when somebody's in renal failure. And then two, a lot of these patients, unless they're hypoglycemic to start with, they just tend to be really sensitive to the insulin too and have these shifts. So I would just encourage people to have more glucose on board than just pure insulin.
Mm-hmm.
They actually did report in this paper, too, one study that just compared insulin and glucose versus glucose alone, and they actually got a pretty good shift of potassium downward with just the glucose alone. So there could be some effect with that, but the real effect, I think, is with the insulin allowing it to be the potassium to be shifted into the skeletal muscles.
So I guess if you give sugar alone, then you're probably causing the patient's endogenous release of insulin, which is a problem if they have diabetes because they're not going to do that.
Right.
But I guess just giving the insulin is going to work faster than waiting on them to release their own.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Typically what I'll do is do, in a normal glycemic patient, at least not a hyperglycemic patient, is give them the D50, then give the insulin, and then give the second dose of D50. But I also do the 2 amps of D50 for sure.
Yep. Yeah,
especially in the normal glycemic, because I have seen and that's how I found out that hypoglycemia looks like seizures.
By treating hyperkalemia?
Yes.
So you already had your nerves your nervous system already acting weird because of the hyperkalemia, and then you throw on the hypoglycemia on top of
That's right.
Benzos don't treat hypoglycemia.
No, the sugar work great, though.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so we've got the insulin plus the D50, and you mentioned albuterol and bicarb. How much and how effective are those?
So albuterol, most people will do about 2.5 milligrams as a nebulizer treatment. You can go up to 5 milligrams, or some people have even gone 10 and 20 milligrams for it. I typically just tend to give them nebs back to back for a while, for at least like an hour to try to get under control. There's no real benefit to using the levoalbuterol versus albuterol. I wouldn't waste the money on that. And this, again, is just going to cause the same type of shift as we did with the insulin and glucose. And then the third drug is the sodium bicarb. There's really no good evidence that this actually works unless they tend to have a metabolic acidosis. And then you can cause a shift of the protons, the hydrogen atoms, to going into the cell with the bicarb, and that, or coming out of the cell, and the potassium will go back in. So if they have an acidosis, then you can cause a nice shift. But otherwise, sodium bicarb doesn't really seem to help much. And it can also cause big fluid shifts, and it's a big salt load for people that are already in end-stage renal disease. So you might have problems with fluid overload and pulmonary edema
sure.
if you continue to use it.
Okay. Ryan, can you take us through the last section of medications that talk about potassium elimination now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is one of the bigger areas where we can present some potentially new information for people. Mm-hmm. As fortunately, you know, 50 plus years in the making, we finally have some new drugs in this realm compared to some of the older drugs. I think most people are familiar with the sodium polystyrene sulfate, the SPS or KX-late, as most people would know it, that has been around since the 1950s as our primary potassium eliminating drug via the GI tract, which removes about 10% of the body's potassium. So when that 90% kidneys don't work, you try and kick in the GI tract and use that work. Unfortunately, the literature on the KX-late and the sodium polystyrene sulfonate is not very good. It was based initially on studies with only about 65 patients, and it was a non-controlled study. Both of the studies that initially got based on the drug approval. And to this day, there have not been a significant amount of well-controlled studies demonstrating that KX-late works better than just decreasing potassium in the diet or just giving the patient time and other therapies in order to get the potassium out.
Sure. Certainly in terms of how quickly you'd want the potassium.
And that's the other thing. From our standpoint in the emergency department, at a minimum, the lowest cited time frame I've ever seen is that it takes a minimum of 2 hours to work. And really most of the studies look out to a day or 2 days even, or even long term to control potassium. And the more unfortunate side is while we don't have any significant clinical data that suggests that it definitely does work, there's a lot of anecdotal data out there, but there is a potential downside. Not an extraordinarily high percentage based on the amount this drug has been used, but up to, in some case reports, 1.8% of patients at the higher end can develop colonic necrosis due to the sorbitol in the potassium and or in the KX-late, excuse me. And if you don't use the sorbitol, then they get really constipated as well. And so that being said, KX-late is not well recommended at this point in time. And there's always been a big push to use it because the other methods using dialysis, things like that, are so aggressive in a lot of these patients. Mm. And fortunately, now we actually have some new drugs on the market from Patiromer in 2015 and now ZS9, the sodium zirconium cyclic drugs that are now available for us to use, which just got approved earlier this year.
It's amazing, though, how bad some of the studies are that got us to believe in this stuff. I remember going through med school and through the early part of my career, everybody just loved KX-late. It was definitely the treatment. You had to use it if somebody had hyperkalemia and no good data to support it. But now more and more cases of this colonic necrosis and seeing more and more lawsuits concerning it too. And I didn't realize this until recently because I guess I don't get all the notifications, but it's actually got a black box warning saying that it can cause colonic necrosis. Mm-hmm. So if they get that and you knew this is a black or should have known it had a black box warning, it winds up becoming really hard to defend.
That's right.
Yeah. It really makes you question mm-hmm. whether to use it. So once again, this is a drug which has its pros and cons, and it seems like the cons, 1.8%, that's not too high, but the pros are really falling off as more literature is coming out about it. I had always learned that KX-Lake primarily works by causing diarrhea, and I guess that kind of made me, and that makes you wonder whether maybe it's the sorbitol, which is actually producing some potassium change, and the KX-Lake portion of that, or whatever the other portion of this concoction, is not really doing much, and kind of makes you wonder, maybe we should just give sorbitol to people to make them poop it out. On the other hand, it sounds like sorbitol itself may be associated with colonic necrosis, so there's not a whole lot of pros to using KX-Lake, and even if it works, it's not going to work quickly.
That's correct. And there actually have been some studies looking at KX-Lake, you know, with sorbitol and sorbitol alone, okay. And some of those studies have actually shown about equivalent removal of potassium in those patients, or at least decrease in their blood potassium level.
Yeah. The other thing is that it really makes the nurses upset, which is probably the biggest drawback, because when you give the KX-Lake, if the patient hasn't gone upstairs yet, they're going to be pooping all over the place in the ED. And if your patient can't tolerate POs, then I had always learned that you give the KX-Lake as a retention enema. I don't know if you guys, Michael,
I've done that. Yeah. I definitely have done that in the ICUs, and that was always a cloud pleaser.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to write that order and leave right away.
Yeah, and actually using it as an enema is actually shown to be higher risk for the colonic.
Oh, really?
I hadn't heard that as well. Yeah.
Okay, good to know. All right, so not a whole lot of pros here. Ryan, you mentioned a couple of other newer drugs that are, I guess, somewhat meant to replace KX-Lake. And we've heard a little bit from the drug companies about this, but I'm guessing that we haven't heard a lot from the drug companies trying to push this because those newer drugs don't really work quickly during an ED shift either. Is that the case?
That's similar. So I think these drugs are much more significantly well studied than KX-Lake was when it first came out. The drug that was approved in 2015, known as Patiramer, or the brand name is Valtessa, is a potassium binding agent that works through the gut, but it won't swell up like the KX-Lake and cause constipation. Mm-hmm. And it's actually been shown pretty well to help control hyperkalemia over a longer period of time. And however, it does take several hours to start working. You don't get your peak effect till, you know, a minimum of 12 to 24 hours.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a lot of the studies were looking at extended outcomes for patients who may be chronically hyperkalemic, going out to a week and even a month in time frame.
Okay. Even we don't have boarding times that bad.
Not so bad. The other drug that recently got approved this year, the sodium polystyrene sulfonate, or ZS9, works in a similar way. We won't get into the pharmacokinetics so much. Has actually been shown to have a few less side effects than the patiramer does, but also seems to have a little bit of a faster onset. So this drug may have promise in the future for emergency medicine. However, any of the studies done on this as well were also looking at extended outcomes, and most of the patients that we see were generally excluded.
Okay, so we've talked about some of those traditional drugs for elimination. Anything else?
So if your patient is able to actually make urine, and I know a number of our patients that come in hyperkalemic are not or don't make a substantial amount of urine, you can theoretically also use some diuretics, whether it's Lasix or a combination of Lasix and HCTZ to work on different areas of the kidney at once. You can help eliminate some of that potassium in that manner. But you need to be careful that your patient is euvolemic or hypervolemic in that case, because you don't want to end up in a situation where you have a diuretic-induced hypovolemia that's going to cause contraction and actually decrease your kidney's elimination of the potassium, mm-hmm. which is not going to be beneficial in that situation.
So not good if your patient is in renal failure from pre-renal causes.
That's right.
Okay.
And if your patient is hypovolemic and you need that, give them fluids. Flush the kidney out. That's what we do in rhabdomyolysis. If the patient has some AKI and a bump in their creatinine because they've been vomiting for a few days and are contracted, then give them fluids. That's going to help their native kidneys kick back in and actually help flush out some of that potassium.
Sure.
And then finally, dialysis is our probably most aggressive, but also our strongest tool in removing potassium. And it's helpful when patients already have access and are already on dialysis, but there are times where we can't get the patient's kidneys kicking back in and their potassium's too high, and we may need to start this, and that's when you need to get your nephrologist in into the ED and get the dialysis started either in the ED or in the ICU.
Okay. So going back to the beginning, the calcium is going to buy you some time to shift the potassium. And then we've got the shifters, and the shifters are going to give you time to eliminate it. Michael, going back to that section you talked about, you mentioned insulin has a duration of maybe up to 90 minutes or so. And then bicarb is equivocal. How long will albuterol help?
It's about the same. Okay. It's typically albuterol is working while you're giving it. It doesn't really last that much longer.
Okay.
Right. So everything's given us just a couple hours really to get dialysis in place or to get them to diurese if you can get their kidneys working.
Okay.
I just wanted to make one point with the furosemide, and just maybe because we're at a teaching hospital, we see this all the time. With the furosemide, when you're giving that, a lot of times people want to give a little dose because they already have some renal insufficiency and they're afraid to make it worse. And I just want to remind everybody that furosemide has to be excreted in order for it to work on the renal tubules. So you actually have to give a really big dose if they have renal insufficiency, if you're going to try it at all. So like most things in life, go big or go home. But give a big dose.
Okay. Yeah. These are going to be your doses of, 60, 80, in some cases, even 100 milligrams of your Lasix rather than your 10s or 20s.
Okay. Yeah. I'd go 160, 200 for those people like creatinines of 3 and 4. If you're going to give a big dose. You can't oversaturate the transporters in Loupa-Henle. So you need to get it in there. And if anything else, they'll just pee it out. So you can't over diurese somebody. If I give you 40 or give you 200, once your receptors are blocked, you're going to just pee anyway. I'm kind of just wasting the drug, but at least I've given you enough to get you to excrete it.
Sure. Okay. If you can't get them dialyzed within those couple of hours, then you're going to probably end up having to repeat the doses of the calcium and the insulin and just keep them maybe on continuous albuterol unless they're getting tachycardic or too jittery. One of the other things I recall many, many years ago, somebody saying was if your patient comes in on a vent, let's say the patient is coming in from a nursing home, chronically ventilated, and they're hyperkalemic, can you just turn up the vent rate and hyperventilate them? Is that going to help with producing some drop in potassium or shift?
To me, that's the equivalent of like giving sodium bicarb. So since the sodium bicarb doesn't work, I don't think hyperventilation will at all because you're basically trying to make them alkalotic. So by breathing it off. So if the sodium bicarb, now if they have a metabolic acidosis, just like the sodium bicarb would work in that stage, then hyperventilating would probably help too. But in general, I wouldn't recommend it.
So transiently, if at all, if they have an acidosis, a lot of ifs.
Correct.
There. Okay. All right. Well, Michael, the paper finishes up with a brief section on cardiac arrest. So let's say that we haven't gotten these things on board quickly enough, or the patient comes in with cardiac arrest and somehow, based on the history, you're really presuming it's hyper-K. If the patient is a dialysis patient and they didn't get dialysis today, almost certainly you're thinking about hyper-K. What do we need to know about cardiac arrest in these patients? Anything different?
I don't think anything's different, really, other than the order. And then the authors do mention one thing that I don't think I've ever seen in my 20 years of doing this. But the first thing they say is give calcium, give lots of calcium. So if you're giving calcium gluconate, you're probably going to give a couple amps of it. Calcium chloride, since that's 3 times the calcium, you'll be able to get away with 1. And this is definitely a time where I would risk giving them the calcium chloride. And I might even give it through their dialysis catheter if they have one. Just so I have a quick central line, because in cardiac arrest, I will access a dialysis catheter, much to the chagrin of my nephrologist, just to have quick access. But then they talk about, so calcium first, and then consider administering epinephrine. And epinephrine can also help with the promotion of potassium redistribution via its beta agonist effects.
Mm-hmm.
But the big thing is calcium first. And they talk about how calcium shouldn't be routinely used in all cardiac arrests, only in those patients that have a really good history. So if you see the dialysis fistula or they have a history of end-stage renal disease, then it's always, I think, reasonable to go with calcium, stabilize everything. And then you could also be giving them the insulin, the D50, to try to do redistribution.
Mm-hmm.
But then they also talk about that some patients will have really good outcomes if you can actually get dialysis started while you're doing CPR. I've just never been in a place that has been able to get the machine there that quickly.
Right.
In order to actually get them hooked up to the machine. And then I would love to see this because I just don't know what kind of flows you'd get if you're actually doing compressions at the same time.
Yeah.
It might be something for us to think about, though, since we've been starting to do ECMO on these patients and then have the ECMO circuit in one place and the dialysis in another place. But I don't know. Have you seen CPR dialysis at the same time?
I've never seen CPR dialysis. Some of the hospitals that I work at, we can get dialysis in the ED. Some places we can't even do dialysis in the ED. They have to go to the ICU or up to the dialysis floor in order to do it. It's an interesting concept, and I agree. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if we can actually get it to work, but I've never been in a situation where it can functionally get it to, unless you're doing CPR for a really long time.
I'd love to hear from any of your readers or the listeners if they've ever had a case of that.
Yeah, I'd be surprised. And certainly the people that do ECMO probably have much more of a mindset of caring for a patient that is in cardiac arrest than the nephrologists and the dialysis techs. I can't imagine they would want anything at all to do with somebody who's in cardiac arrest. We have a tough time getting dialysis on people who are unstable in any way, let alone somebody in cardiac arrest. So, all right. Well, that was a great review. Let me ask if both of you perhaps can just give us your, how about your top three take-home points from the article? Ryan, how about you first?
So number one, I think, is if you have EKG changes, give calcium. It's going to be the fastest and most efficient way to stabilize those membranes and really help buy you some time to initiate some of your other therapies.
All right.
Number two is avoid K-oxalate. It's not shown to work and can have some potential downside.
All right. Sounds good.
And then number three, I really like the point made about doing the double dose of glucose along with the insulin. I've seen it too many times where the patient becomes hypoglycemic. And I think this is a really good practice unless the patient is already profoundly hyperglycemic.
Great.
Which happens not infrequently.
Okay. Michael, you got a few for us?
I think one pertinent one is that the EKG cannot exclude hyperkalemia. You could have signs and say, oh, it looks like it, but just a normal EKG doesn't mean that they can't have hyperkalemia on labs. If you're going to give furosemide to somebody that has some renal insufficiency but still urinates, just give a really big dose.
Go big.
Go big or go home. And then I agree with the D50 as a common error that I see all the time with people getting hypoglycemic. So please have your patients at least on Q1 hour, at a minimum, Q1 hour AccuChecks. And at least the first one should be 30 minutes later just to make sure that they're not going to get hypoglycemic.
Sure. Great points. All right, Michael, Ryan, thanks so much for taking us through this article. And again, even though hyperkalemia is a common thing in bread and butter, I certainly did learn a few new things there. So great, thanks.
Thanks for having us on.
All right. Well, it's time for us to do a quick wrap-up of the February EM cast. We started things out with aortic stenosis. Aortic stenosis is common. 26% of the population over age 65 will develop aortic stenosis, and it's therefore it's something that we all need to know about. And these patients with aortic stenosis can be very tenuous. They're walking on thin ice when they come into the emergency department with any cardiovascular type of complications. The classic triad that we always worry about is angina, syncope, and decompensated heart failure. I mentioned the mnemonic that helps me remember this triad, ASD, which stands for aortic stenosis disease. ASD also stands for angina, syncope, and decompensated heart failure. And as a patient progresses from angina to syncope to decompensated heart failure over the course of time, their prognosis gets worse and worse and worse. And when you have any of these patients showing up in your emergency department with any of these, best thing you can do is manage them carefully, get them to cardiology or in some cases a vascular or cardiovascular surgeon, and they may need a new valve. Be very careful because they are so tenuous. You want to be careful when using medications. Ideally, don't put them on high dose pressors because the left ventricle already is having a tough time pumping forward. Now it's got to pump against even more resistance. So if you need vasopressors, go with low dose. If they're hypotensive, you can supplement them with some gentle IV hydration. And we also recommend that if you're going to use any medications in these patients, whenever possible, go with titratable medications. Even if you're using, say, nitroglycerin because they've got angina symptoms, I'd probably put them on a nitro drip, because they're very preload sensitive, very afterload sensitive. And so if they suddenly drop their blood pressure, you want to be able to have them on a drip so that you can hit the off button and your medication goes away fairly quickly. So be careful with these patients. And again, if they're presenting with any of the cardinal three symptoms, angina, syncope, decompensated heart failure, probably ought to be thinking about getting these patients admitted to a unit, getting cardiology and sometimes cardiovascular surgery involved early. Next, we talked about dizzy patients once again. Last time Danya came and spoke with us, she talked about a great Jonathan Edlow paper, which talked about persistent dizziness. And this time, Dr. Edlow has written about episodic dizziness. And so Danya covered that topic. Key things to think about when you've got a patient with episodic dizziness is the dizziness triggered by something the patient's doing, for example, head turning or changes in body position, or is it totally spontaneous? So when they have episodic dizziness, is it triggered or spontaneous? If it's triggered, you want to think about benign positional vertigo, you think about orthostatic hypotension, things like that. If, on the other hand, it is spontaneous, then you worry about vestibular migraine, you worry about Meniere's disease, and of course you worry about central causes like TIA. You want to really do a good cranial nerve and bulbar type of exam and a good cerebellar exam. In patients that have benign positional vertigo, of course you can think about using the Epley maneuver. Epley maneuver is very good. You could just do a YouTube video on some of these maneuvers. Not only the Dix-Hall pipe maneuver, but the Epley maneuver. Both of these are things that I think every emergency physician ought to know how to do, and it's pretty easy. If you don't know how to do it, I'm not going to describe it to you. Just go on YouTube or Google videos or something like that. There's plenty of stuff on the internet. Take 3, 4, 5 minutes and learn how to do these maneuvers for diagnostic and treatment purposes. It's very important. And then we finish things up by talking about a bread and butter topic, and that is hyperkalemia, and specifically going a bit beyond bread and butter, maybe toast and jam. We talked about controversies in hyperkalemia. And just as a reminder about some of the basics, clinical manifestations that we worry the most about are cardiac. We worry about dysrhythmias, both tachy and brady dysrhythmias, but patients can develop on the ECG. Cardiac manifestations can include ST elevation, ST depression, new bundle branch blocks, vesicular blocks, in addition to the tachys and bradys, just about anything on the 12-lead EKG. But there's some other interesting presentations as well. Patients can present with neurologic signs and symptoms, paresthesias, and weakness, paralysis. There's an entity called hyperkalemic periodic paralysis that's worth knowing about. And when a patient comes in with severe hyperkalemia, they can have extreme weakness to the point of making you think they're having a stroke. But usually it's not so much of a focal issue, it's just global inability to move much at all. And once you treat that hyperkalemia, it resolves. Interestingly, I'm digressing a little bit, but interestingly, there's also an entity called hypokalemic periodic paralysis. So severe derangements of potassium, either too high or too low, can cause severe muscular weakness. And then, of course, gastroenterology type of symptoms, GI symptoms, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and so on. In terms of treatment, there's a few major categories of treatment. You want to stabilize the cardiac membranes. You do that with calcium gluconate or calcium chloride. Remember that calcium chloride is 3 times more potent than calcium gluconate. So, for example, 1 amp or 10 cc's or 1 gram of calcium chloride, you would need 3 grams or 30 cc's or 3 amps of calcium gluconate. Calcium chloride, generally, we only want to use through a central line, though, because it's very sclerosing. So if you have a patient with a central line, give them 1 dose of calcium chloride. If you have a peripheral line, give them 2 or 3 doses of calcium gluconate, or three amps of calcium gluconate to equal that 1 amp of calcium chloride. But be aggressive with that calcium when patients are starting to have cardiac instability. So that's membrane stabilization. Secondarily, we want to redistribute the potassium from the intravascular fluid, shove it into the cells to protect the heart. And how do you do that? Well, you can use insulin. You can use sodium bicarb, which there's some controversy about how effective it is, but it does help with cardiac symptoms temporarily. You can also use albuterol, but that doesn't work as quickly as you would think. And also, don't forget that when you use insulin, you need to make sure that they don't get hypoglycemic, and we like to give 2 amps of D50, not just 1 amp of D50, and make sure you check their sugar. So redistributing potassium, how do you do it? Insulin, bicarb, albuterol. Don't forget the dextrose. And then definitive treatment of hyperkalemia, you want to get rid of it from the body. And we initiated the discussion by talking about sodium polystyrene, also better known as, dare I use the brand name, but K-Exalate is probably what all of you know about, or know it as. And there's a lot of controversy about K-Exalate. It is associated in about 2% of cases with colonic necrosis. So there's a very small chance of harm, but more recent studies over the past couple of decades have really shown that there's not much benefit, actually, from the K-Exalate. So practically no benefit, small risk of real harm. You know, we've really gotten away from using K-Exalate. I would say that it's still in a lot of the textbooks, so I don't think it's below the standard of care to use it, because I don't think a lot of people know how useless it is. But get the word out there and get people to stop using K-Exalate. It really is not a great medication, probably doesn't help much at all in the acute setting. What else can you use? Well, you can use furosemide. If a patient still urinates, you can get them to pee it out. Use furosemide. Make sure they're hydrated first, though, so give them some IV fluids. And simply giving them IV fluids oftentimes will make them pee, but combining hydration plus the furosemide will help them get rid of the potassium. But again, before you give furosemide, make sure they are euvolemic. And then finally, of course, dialysis. If a patient's in cardiac arrest, go heavy on the calcium. And again, the last point that we'll make with hyperkalemia is that although the ECG is the most important, quickest, and early first test that you want to get, severe hyperkalemia can sometimes be associated with a really unremarkable EKG. It's interesting how some patients can develop severe hyper-K on the EKG with levels of 6.5 or 6.7, and yet other patients I've seen have fairly unremarkable EKGs with levels of 7.5 or 8. So the EKG is not 100%, but once that EKG does start showing signs, you've got to use calcium, or you should use calcium. And if you get high potassium levels and the EKG doesn't show anything, you probably don't need the calcium, but you still need to treat the patient. All right. Well, that's it for the February issue. I hope everybody out there is staying warm. And we've got some great topics for you next month set up already. So until March 1st, hope everyone stays warm and does well. Talk to you later.
Hey, thanks for listening to MCAST. And for listening to the end, here's a discount code for you. Use discount code PODCAST for 10% off each year of an annual subscription to emedhome.com.